James decided Annie and Shipman must have talked things over, because Shipman saddled his horse after breakfast the next morning, haltered half the mules, and made his goodbyes to James.
Half the mules are yours. Since you're going to stay here and be a farmer, I figure you can make good use of them.
I thought you might want to stay here too. It's good land. I've got enough for you and Annie if you want it.
For me and Annie? You Lewises are great ones for wanting people to get married and sit down in one place like a fence post. You're a pretty good partner, James. Took to the business right off. But I can't afford to stay around and keep pulling you out of the scrapes you get into. Next time, you could get me killed. You watch out for yourself now.
Annie stood at the cabin, watching from a distance. Shipman raised his head and glanced in her direction a minute, lifted his hand in a half salute, and left. The mules jogged along behind him. He struck out down the river. James walked reluctantly back to the cabin. Annie stood there with a look in her eyes as if she wanted to cry, but had made up her mind not to.
There ain't many things that Sly's afraid of, but marriage is one. Annie did. I mean, I'm going to be worrying for the next month or two if you don't tell me.
You got no cause to worry. It didn't go that far.
You stopped him, did you? I'm proud of you for your good judgment.
It wasn't me who stopped. It was him. I guess if I'd had good judgment, I'd have stayed in Tennessee.
Annie turned and went into the kitchen, closing the door behind her as a sign that she wanted to be left alone. James had no quarrel with that. He hitched up two of the mules and went out into the woods to drag poles for the fence. The day Shipman left was the day Michael Lewis came home. With him was his old friend from Bar, Alessandro Zaragoza, and Zaragoza's son, Manuel, now about 13. After stopping a while at his own cabin to kiss Marie and the children, Michael had gone by Andrew's and Petra's. Finally, late in the afternoon, he and Zaragoza arrived at the cabin James shared with Annie. They were trailed by Manuel and Mordecai, who lagged behind. The boys had become close friends. Annie had kept her own silent counsel all day. James surmised that she was grieving over Shipman's leaving. But she brightened at the sight of her older brother. Michael had always occupied a special place in her heart. She threw her arms around him.
Oh, we might, they might have killed you.
Nobody's ever killed me yet. Mighty good to have you home again, little brother. I hope this time you can stay.
I sure figure on it.
James shook hands with Zaragoza. It had always puzzled him a little, Michael's friendship with this dark, leathery-skinned Mexican. They seemed on the surface to have almost nothing in common. But they had fought side by side in earlier times, and each had saved the other's life. He supposed shared experiences like that might make people forget their racial differences.
Micah, how did you two meet up this time? The fighting was to the east, and Senior Zaragoza lives to the west.
Well, Alessandro and Manuel were over the coast selling horses when the trouble started. Brad Byrne figured they were thieves or something and tried to confiscate the horses. I helped him drive the bunch out of his reach.
That Brad Byrne, he must be a son of a bitch.
Nah, he's just another little two-bit tyrant who had more power than was good for him. Piedras is a fair man, though. He turned Brad Byrne's prisoners loose and countermanded a lot of Brad Byrne's orders. So Brad Byrne turned in his papers and went back to Mexico. Like as not, we've seen the last of him. Maybe we've seen the last of our quarrels with Mexico. Looks like we got a lot of them all patched up.
Zaragoza did not appear to share Michael's confidence.
It is to be hoped.
They pulled most of the soldiers back down into Mexico. They're fighting a revolution down there to throw Bustamante out of power. There's a young general by the name of Santa Anna who says he wants to restore the Constitution to 1824. I think we'd all be happy with that.
I know of this Santa Anna. He is much popular with the people, but he is one who watches always which way the wind blows. If it blows east, he goes east. If it blows west, he goes west. Today it blows for the Constitution. Tomorrow?
James hesitated to bring up the subject with Zaragoza here, but he decided to do it anyway.
I heard a lot of people talking when I was at Velasco. They're saying what Texas needs is to be independent from Mexico. Then we wouldn't have to worry about the likes of Brad Byrne or Bustamante or Santa Anna or any of them. We'd elect our own, and if they didn't do what we wanted, we'd vote them out and start all over, like back home.
This isn't Tennessee. It isn't the United States. I think most of the old settlers would be glad enough just to have the Constitution back. It guaranteed us our rights. Give us that and we've got no quarrel with Mexico.
But will they give us that? I think independence is what we need.
Would you be willing to kill for it?
I'm afraid I already have.
Sergeant Diaz was disappointed. He had hoped the uprising at Anahuac and Velasco would give the central government gumption enough to bring in an army of invasion and drive the Americans from Texas for once and for all. Certainly, it should have opened the eyes of those in Mexico City to the danger of tolerating these extranjeros who showed every intention of wresting Texas from Mexico and delivering it into the hands of the United States of the North. He regarded Colonel José de las Piedras as a fool. He should have supported Juan Bradburn and crushed the rebels with an iron will instead of countermanding Bradburn and forcing that worthy patriot to resign. It was true, of course, that Bradburn had abused his authority, but it was his authority and the central government should have supported him. Rebellion, whatever its motivation, should never be tolerated. Order should always be the first priority. Grievances should be addressed by authority, never by the mob. That had traditionally been the Army's view, and Diaz had never questioned it, even when his conscience told him that authority was wrong. He was, first and last, a soldier. In drawing a major part of its soldiers from Texas after Anahuac, the Army had chosen for the moment to leave them in the reduced garrison at San Antonio de Bar. He had mixed feelings about that. In a way, he would have preferred to go where the real fighting was, against the tyrant Bustamante, who had seized control from the rightful President Guerrero. That fight was being led now by Antonio López de Santa Anna, Mexico's hero of the hour. Santa Anna had promised to restore the liberal constitution of 1824 and end Bustamante's oppression of the people. He was supported by most of the army, so it seemed a foregone conclusion that he would win. On the other hand, Diaz felt some gratification in being left here in Texas. He could at least watch what the Americans were doing, though he had little hope that anyone in higher authority would listen to his warnings about them. No one paid much attention to a mere sergeant. He had noted that many Americans, particularly those who had been in Texas for some years and had accumulated property, were vocal in their support for Santa Anna. They were saying that restoration of their rights under the Constitution of 1824 would make them happy to remain under the benevolent banner of Mexico. But others, particularly those who had no property and therefore little to lose, loudly advocated that Texas become independent. Diaz suspected that was the true feeling of most American Texans, no matter how often they proclaimed their loyalty. They had been fed generously by the hand of Mexico, and now they were ready to bite that hand like a pampered cat turned surly and mean. Diaz briefly saw at least a ray of hope. Colonel José Antonio Mejía, who had just captured the city of Matamoros from Bustamante's forces, decided to make an expedition into Texas to determine for himself the true situation. Sailing up the Gulf Coast to the mouth of the Brazos, he brought with him some 400 men. That should be enough to whip the Americans into submission if Mejía chose that course. He didn't see how the colonel could decide otherwise once he observed the Texans' perfidy. What Diaz didn't know at the time was that the Texas impresario Stephen F. Austin had hurried to Matamoros to join Mejía to argue that the uprising against Bradburn had been over personal grievances and was not directed against the central government. Moreover, Austin had sent word to his colonists to make Mejía welcome wherever he went and to demonstrate their loyalty with fervor. By the time the Mejía expedition reached the Brazos River and a grand reception in his honor, the colonel had already been softened by Austin's power of persuasion. He was feted everywhere he went, treated to the best the Texans could offer in food and drink. With warm feelings toward his hosts, he gathered most of the remaining troops from Texas and ordered them to the interior of Mexico. They were needed there, he decided, to hasten Santa Anna's victory. Among them now was to be Sergeant Diaz. A native of the Nacogdoches area in northeastern Texas, he had never been to the interior of the country. Texas was his home, and he saw it slipping away little at a time to people of an alien kind. The day before he was to begin the march, he saddled his horse and rode out to the farm of his old friend and former commander, Alessandro Zaragoza. They greeted one another with the abrazo, the embrace of friendship.
I heard of your orders. I will be sorry to see you leave.
And I am sorry to go. I have come to believe that the true fight for Mexico will be here, my lieutenant.
Diaz always referred to Zaragoza as lieutenant, though Zaragoza had long since retired from the military and settled down to the life of a farmer on land which had belonged to his father-in-law.
We will be leaving you at the mercy of the Americans.
And that still troubles you?
Very much. You have ridden among the colonies. You have seen them just as I have. What do you see of Mexico in any of them? They have their own government, and it is a government modeled after that of the United States. They have begun to build schools, but they do not teach them from Mexicano books. They do not even teach our language.
There are Mexicano settlements. Bar remains almost entirely Mexicano. So does La Bahia.
Islands in an American ocean. The tide will wash over them, and nothing Mexicano will be left. It is illegal now for more Americanos to come into Tejas, yet more come every day. The law is like an old watchdog that has no teeth. With the few troops we have, trying to stop them is like trying to stop the geese from going south in the winter.
Diaz observed Zaragoza's son Manuel in a corral, riding a half-broken colt around and around.
If we do not stop them, what will become of your son and those who come after him? He will be living in an American land, not a Mexicano one, if they let him stay here at all.
Zaragoza placed a hand on Diaz's shoulder and nodded toward his front door.
Come on into the house. Let us drink to your safe journey. Elvira, a bottle of wine for our honored guest.
Elvira brought a bottle of wine made from Zaragoza's own vines. Diaz tried not to stare at her, but he could not help himself, for he had always considered her a rare beauty, with olive skin, raven black hair, and dark eyes that would melt a man into his boots. Would that he had such a woman to come home to at night, to share his supper and his bed. It pained him to think of her someday losing this good home to some grasping American, or becoming a penniless refugee thrown out upon the road. That, he feared, was the fate of all Mexicans in Texas, unless the steady invasion could be stopped and the Americans pushed back beyond their own border. Zaragoza poured 3 glasses of wine, passing one to Elvira and one to Diaz.
You do not see the Americans as I have seen them. You have never made friends among them.
I tried, as you will remember. My family tried. All they did was enslave us and kill my sister.
Are there not Mexicanos who would do the same? You judge the many by the few.
I can only judge what I have seen. And I have seen that side of their nature. You have been spared that view, my lieutenant, or you would not be so complacent.
I am afraid this is a subject on which we will always disagree, old friend. Let us talk of more pleasant things. Let us talk of Mexico and better times.
Diaz lifted his glass in salute.
To Mexico, where at last I will see no more Americanos.
To Mexico and to the Constitution. When it is restored, there will be no more fighting. No need for rebellion.
To Santa Ana, who will restore the Constitution.
Zaragoza hesitated, only reluctantly joining the toast.
To Santa Ana. May he be a man of his word, a man devoted to freedom and justice, and not simply another Bustamante.
Do you doubt him, my lieutenant? They say he is a great patriot.
But a patriot to what? To Mexico? Or to himself? If he is only for himself, as so many others have been, I tremble for Mexico. I tremble for Tejas.
The The peace which followed his withdrawal of troops was a happy illusion which would not long endure. That fall, Andrew Lewis was called to attend a San Felipe convention representing the Texas settlements to appraise existing conditions and suggest improvements. Of the three Lewis brothers, he was considered most likely to sit still for such a session. The restless Michael would probably only stray off somewhere looking for a country he had never seen. James was considered still too young and unsettled to ponder the seriousness of affairs of state. Andrew was the statesman, the one most likely to see all sides of a problem and find a path towards settlement agreeable to all parties. Though conceived with good intentions, the convention planted new seeds of mistrust that would eventually flower into conflict. Such a convention was typically American, but contrary to Mexican custom. The Mexican town of San Antonio de Bar failed to send delegates might have been recognized as a portent of the reaction in Mexico itself, had the convention been inclined toward that sort of introspection. Andrew was not surprised to find a considerable division of opinion. A faction largely of the newer Texans talked independence among themselves, but did not submit such a radical notion to a vote. The more conservative old settlers, including himself, favored accommodation with Mexico under the original Constitution. They named a committee to write a resolution asking Mexico to rescind the anti-immigration law of 1830, which had been largely ignored after the first months, but under which later immigrants were considered illegal and not entitled to citizenship. They also asked for lower tariffs on certain necessities and for the creation of a school fund. The thorniest issue was a request that Texas be given statehood separate from Coahuila. Though opposed by some of the old settlers, it won majority approval. Andrew cast a vote in favor, but wondered how it would fare with Mexican politicians, to whom even such a convention as this one smacked of rebellion. His concerns turned out to be well-founded. Don José de la Garza, political chief in Bar, wrote the governor of Coahuila that the request was but a symptom of mounting insurrection.
A true Mexican can but bitterly deplore his misfortune and feel sore at the foreign hand that has come boldly to rob him of his rights.
In his view, an assemblage to voice public sentiment was tantamount to revolution, for inevitably that was where such meetings had always led in Mexico. Andrew rode home from the convention feeling that it had done good work in the main. When all the Lewis families gathered on a Sunday afternoon, which was their custom, he spoke to Michael, James, and Cousin Frank.
I think they'll know down in Mexico that we're still loyal to the government, that all we want is for Texas to blossom and grow.
Not until much later would Andrew discern that the effect had been the opposite, that slowly but certainly the stage was being prepared for conflagration. Texas, 1835. James worried about Annie. After 5 years in Texas, she still gave no sign that she was ever going to marry. He could see himself in his old age, supporting an old maid's sister who never had been totally satisfied with anything he did and would probably outlive him just for the cussedness of it. Times he would almost be satisfied to see her marry Isaac Blackwood. Isaac still came around now and again, doing little favors for Annie, bringing her things like jugs of honey or bear grease for cooking, or an occasional backstrap and hindquarter of venison. Anything to earn a smile from her. He would go away as happy as a dog granted a few pats on the head. Nor was Isaac the only suitor. Others came from as far away as San Felipe, for men still outnumbered women in the Texas colonies. Annie gave them even less encouragement than she offered Isaac. James was pretty sure he knew what the trouble was. She still yearned after Sly Shipman, though she had not seen or heard from him once since he had ridden away that summer day not long after the battle at Velasco. She would occasionally talk about her other suitors. She never mentioned Shipman's name. That was how James knew. But he had worries more pressing than Annie's lack of romance. He was well aware that the pot was bubbling in Mexico, that sooner or later it would boil over, and that Texas was likely to be scalded. Each traveler passing through the colony, especially if he came from Bar or the direction of Mexico, was closely questioned for news, for any information that might yield some hint of what was to come. James would not have been overly surprised if he had looked up from his plowing one day and seen the whole Mexican army marching down the hill toward him. A second Texan convention, conducted in 1833, had been bolder than the first. Andrew again had gone as a delegate. Into this one strode a new figure, a delegate from San Augustine, who towered over most other men. He was Sam Houston, still less than 40 years old, but already a former governor of Tennessee, recently come into Texas after a long sojourn among the Cherokee Indians in Arkansas. His reputation had preceded him. Even so, Andrew had been surprised and impressed by Houston's eloquence and bearing, his physical size, and by the way he seemed to dominate any room into which he walked. But there had been something about Houston which bothered Andrew.
There's Stephen F. Austin, the man who brought the first of us into Texas. The man who's held Texas together all these years with sweat and blood and guts. The man we owe everything to. Yet when Sam Houston comes in, it's like Austin isn't even there anymore. It's like he doesn't matter. Everybody's attention goes to Houston.
From what I heard, Houston was a great scrapper back in Tennessee. Maybe he's what Texas needs to keep Mexico from overrunning us.
What Texas needs is a calm and steady hand. Austin has been real good for us all these years.
But Texas was to lose Austin's good services during a most critical period in its existence as part of the Mexican nation. The convention not only asked again for a separate statehood apart from Coahuila, but wrote a constitution for that proposed state over Austin's objections. Against his better judgment, Austin carried it to Mexico City on behalf of the colonies he represented, in company with his friend Lorenzo de Zavala, a member of the Mexican cabinet. As before, it provoked a hostile reaction. It was widely regarded as part of a plot to separate Texas from the rest of Mexico and deliver it over to the United States. Austin was imprisoned, and de Zavala fled Mexico City for Texas. For a year and a half, Austin languished in a dungeon that had been used during the Spanish Inquisition, while Texans quarreled over where to turn and what to do. The news out of Mexico was discouraging. Santa Anna had revealed the ugly side of his face. After coming to power on a promise of reinstating the Constitution of 1824, he repudiated it. The state government of Coahuila had made welcome concessions to Texas. Legalization of immigration, lower tariffs, improvement in the mails. But Santa Anna nullified all this. He disbanded Mexico's Republican Congress and set up a new one subservient to his demands. He abolished the state legislatures and local ayuntamientos, declaring that all rules in the future would be written in Mexico City, and that the pen would be his own. When the liberal state of Zacatecas rebelled, he marched in with a force of 5,000 men and laid to waste whatever stood in his way, leaving bloody scenes of wholesale rape and murder as an object lesson for any in Mexico who would defy his will. Long a student of Francis Bonaparte, he declared himself the Napoleon of the West and turned his attention to the restive North, to Coahuila, which had fallen into chaos and civil war. He dispatched his brother-in-law, General Martin Perfecto de Cos, with a large body of soldiers to reconquer Coahuila and bring it under the military dictatorship centered in Mexico City. Ahead of Cos, Coahuilan officials and other refugees poured across the Rio Grande, bringing with them their fears and their hatred for Santa Anna. These emotions spread like an epidemic across Texas, finding ready reception among American settlers who by now were fearful about their own future. In Texas, after the relative calm which had followed the Anahuac and Velasco affairs, it seemed that history had come full circle, for the central government reestablished its customs offices in those two places. Citizens resisted, blood was spilled, men were thrown in jail. the time was ripe for William Barrett Travis and Sam Houston and others of the War Party persuasion who had long advocated that Texas should break free of the Mexican yoke. Stephen F. Austin could no longer bring his sober influence to bear on Mexico's behalf. He remained in prison, charged with treason for having advocated a constitution. Time was ripe also for those in Mexico who called for taking Texas back from the Americans. The voices of reason and goodwill were smothered on both sides by the call for war. James Lewis plowed his field and harvested his garden and cared for his few cattle. But he did so with a needling restlessness, his eyes going often to the horizon. He knew Mexico had remanned its abandoned garrisons. It seemed only a question of time until the soldiers marched across the land to establish once and for all the supremacy of Mexico over these immigrant Texans. Santa Anna had made it clear in Zacatecas and Coahuila. All who opposed him, even in a minor way, would be crushed beneath the boots of his army. He took no prisoners and granted no mercy. No longer was he the liberal savior of his nation. He was its emperor, and he ruled by blood and fire. James found it hard to accept the relative calm of his brother Andrew, who spoke little of the troubles but took care of his work, planting and cultivating his fields as if he had no concern for what was happening to the South, out of his sight, as if he knew he would remain on this piece of land forever.
You know how many revolutions there have already been in Mexico. There are a lot of people down there who hate Santa Anna. Chances are they'll rise up against him before the trouble ever gets this far north. Anyway, we're farmers, not soldiers. They'd only let Austin out of jail.
But James suspected his brother harbored fears he did not want to reveal, lest they frighten the women and children. Rumors that summer of 1835 had spread through Texas like a prairie fire, and gloom had laid itself across the land like smoke from that consuming blaze. If wild reports were to be believed, Santa Anna was marching north with 10,000 men, and Mexican agents were out among the horseback Indian tribes, firing them up for war against the Texans. Michael's reaction was different from Andrew's, as James would expect it to be. Michael continued his work, but he did it with a nervous energy, attacking the ground with the plow as if it were a weapon of war. Like James, he paused often to look to the horizon. James had learned to recognize the symptoms. One morning, Marie would rise up to find herself in bed alone, her husband gone to God knew where, to return God knew when. She must sense that herself, for she had been through it before. But Marie gave no sign, nor did Petra and Annie betray any foreboding of the events that were rapidly overtaking them. James pondered sometimes if the women might not be the strongest of them all. The crops were almost in when Elizondo Zaragoza arrived one Sunday afternoon with his son Manuel. All the Lewises were gathered at Michael and Marie's cabin. Michael strode out in front of the others to greet his old friend.
Mighty happy to see you, Elizondo. Get down and join us. We'll be having supper directly.
I am not happy to be here, Miguel. It is a bad wind that has blown us to this place.
Zaragoza stared westward in the direction from which he had come.
We left in the middle of the night. Ugarte Chia is in the garrison of Bar. He has a list. Men to be arrested, men who have spoken out. Men to be shot as traitors to Santa Anna.
Michael and Andrew exchanged knowing glances.
You're on the list?
Yes.
And what of the boy? He's not old enough to have gotten mixed up in politics.
He is 14. He is old enough to be shot in my place if they do not find me.
Andrew and James wore doubting looks.
You do not know them. But I have been a soldier. I know them much too well.
What about the rest of your family?
I do not believe they will harm Elvira or the young ones. But I fear for Manuel.
You're mighty welcome to stay here with us until the storm blows over.
The storm is barely begun. It will come here if we cannot stop it.
Then where do you plan to go?
I am not sure. Resistance is building in many places. I go to find the resistance and join it.
But your boy, he's not old enough to go fighting.
I am old enough to fight beside my father.
He thinks he is, but of course he is not. I would leave him here if you would keep him. Even if the soldiers come, they do not know him. He can use another name.
Papa, I want to go with you.
but he could see in his father's eyes that this was not to be. Manuel lowered his chin in sadness. As the boy dismounted, Mordecai put his arm around Manuel's shoulder. He didn't speak. He didn't have to. Next morning, when the family awakened, Alessandro Zaragoza had already gone, and Michael Lewis had gone with him. As the crops were harvested and farmers were freed from the tyranny of the fields, they began to gather in various places, rifles in their hands, unsure what to do, but knowing they should do something. Many of them passed James's place, and he itched to go with them, perhaps to find where Michael had gone. But he held back, awaiting direction, awaiting a call. As if in warning of calamity to come, a mysterious comet lighted the Texas skies that fall. A spectral visitor that chilled brave hearts and set the superstitious to talking about the end of the world.
That's a bad omen if I ever saw one.
Yeah, it's just a comet. Doesn't mean anything.
Books say comets have been flying around ever since Eve pulled the apple trick on Adam. Even if it meant anything, they're probably seeing it the same in Mexico as we do here. Maybe it means bad luck for the Mexicans instead of for us.
Frank would be the one to know, for he was always the reader in the Lewis family. He knew all manner of things that were of no earthly use to a working man. James had about made up his mind to take his rifle and go in search of Michael when the wagons came. He and Annie were at Marie's, helping her and Mordecai and Manuel harvest her garden. The wagons came into sight over a rise from the east. James looked up from the work and wondered idly who would be taking wagons westward. That trail led toward San Antonio de Bar, where Coss and his troops held their presidio, awaiting reinforcements from the interior before venturing out into the colonies to assert Santa Ana's control. Most of the traffic James had seen lately had been coming from Bar, not traveling toward it. But he put his curiosity aside and bent to the work again, for it would take the wagon some time to get here. He noticed, after a bit, that Marie was becoming excited.
It cannot be.
She hurried to the rail fence. Though she wore a bonnet, she shaded her eyes with her hand.
Papa? Papa!
James squinted. Surely enough, he recognized old Baptiste Villaret on the lead wagon, driving a pair of big, strong mules. Marie scaled the fence, skirt flaring, jumped down on the other side, and went running. Villaret climbed from the wagon and trotted stiffly to meet her, limping from the arthritis in his deteriorating knees.
Marie!
They grabbed each other. They were still embracing, tears flowing down their cheeks without shame when James reached them. He had taken his time. For the moment, it was as if he didn't exist, so far as father and daughter were concerned. They had not set eyes on each other in all the years Marie had lived here.
I wish you'd look who's coming yonder.
The second wagon trailed some distance behind, but James recognized the driver, Sly Shipman. He glanced back at Annie. A broad smile brightened her face to a degree he had not seen in years. But she brought it under control as Shipman neared. By the time he halted the mules and climbed down, that smile was gone. She looked almost severe.
Back already?
Marie called her children about her. It was the first time they had met their grandfather. Old Villaret, who seemed grayer and more bent than when James had last seen him, embraced each in turn, speaking French to them and taking delight in their responses. Marie had seen to it that all learned to know French and Spanish as well as English. It was part of their heritage. It had always struck James as strange, the times he'd heard French coming from young Mordecai's lips. Mordecai was like a young copy of Michael, and James couldn't picture Michael ever speaking French. James shook hands with Shipman. Annie had already spoken all the welcome she was going to give him, at least for now. She moved back to share in the glow that had built around Marie and her father and the youngsters. She had met Villaret briefly 5 years ago when she and James and Frank and his family had passed through Natchitoches on their way to Texas. Shipman's eyes were on Annie.
Has she been mad for the whole 3 years?
I've seen her a few times when she wasn't.
I was hoping...
Papa, why have you come? After all this time, why are you here?
To bring the wagons. To take all of you to safety in Nacogdoches.
To safety? I do not understand.
We hear many things in Nacogdoches. Bad things from Mexico. Your mama and me, we think it is too dangerous for you to stay here. I want you to come with me back to Louisiana. Santa Ana will not cross the Sabine.
But Papa, this is our home.
If you stay, it could be your grave.
There is one grave here already.
Marie pointed up the slope to a little fenced-off spot where the baby lay buried.
We have paid much for this place. We do not leave it.
Villeray stared at her, studying the rigid lines of resolve in her face.
I will talk to Michael.
Michael is not here. That is another reason I cannot go. I have to wait here for Michael.
Where is he gone?
James thought for a moment he saw tears in Marie's eyes before she blinked them away.
I do not know. Somewhere to fight, I think. I could not go and not know what has become of him.
Perhaps. We will talk about it some more later. Now let me love my grandchildren again.
They all began walking toward the cabin. Annie started after them.
Annie, just a minute.
She stopped, but didn't turn. He had to walk around her to face her.
Annie, he's serious. I'm serious. It's dangerous for you all to stay here with war fixing to bust out around you. That's why we came with the wagon, so we can haul you out of here.
You heard Marie. This is her home. She's raised her family here, buried a child here.
You ain't raised a family here.
And not likely to, either. It's twice now you've ridden off and left me. Why didn't you just stay gone?
Because I'm scared for you. Because I don't want anything to happen to you.
And why would you care?
Because, damn it, woman, I love you.
Say that again.
You heard me. What do you want me to do, get down on my knees?
No, I heard you. I just wanted to be sure you heard yourself. I don't know one good reason I should love you, Sly Shipman. I could think of a dozen good reasons why I shouldn't.
James saw that he wasn't needed. He walked away and left them standing there trying to crush the breath from each other. Time did not change Marie's mind about leaving. All her father's efforts at persuasion went for nothing, though he kept trying for several days. He begged James and Andrew, Frank, Hope, and Annie to talk to her, but it was to no avail. Marie had as much stubborn determination as if she'd been born a Lewis rather than married into the name. They had considerable company during the days that Baptiste Villeray remained, enjoying his grandchildren, hoping their mother might yet change her mind. Horsemen rode by singly and in small groups, all moving toward San Antonio de Bar. A familiar face was among them, a portly, one-eyed minister named Fairweather. James remembered him from Velasco. Andrew knew him from much farther back.
You fixing to go fight, preacher?
Big events are afoot, young gentlemen. I fear that there will shortly be much need for prayer. I carry the Lord's word where it is needed the most.
A chilling report had come from the town of Gonzales. First blood had been drawn. A force had marched out from the bar garrison to retrieve a cannon the government had lent some years earlier to the citizens of Gonzales for defense against Indian attack. The Texans had raised a homemade banner emblazoned with the words, "Come and take it." Rifles had spoken an even bolder message. The cannon had been loaded with scrap iron and pieces of chain and fired in the direction of the soldiers. The Mexicans had retreated, trailing blood. Texas had had her Lexington. There would no longer be doubt. The war was on. James felt a strong urge to saddle Walker and ride with some of the men who passed by. They were on their way to drive Koss out of Bar, they claimed. But he waited, thinking Marie might yet decide to leave. For if she did, Hope would go, and Annie, and all the children at least. But Marie showed no sign of weakening. James decided he had stayed as long as he could. He was at the shed, brushing Walker's back to get the bay horse ready for the trip, when Isaac Blackwood rode up. Isaac had his long rifle across his lap, blankets tied behind the cantle of his saddle, a bag of possibles hanging down on one side. James sensed at a glance that he too was headed for Bar. Isaac watched James throw a blanket and saddle on Walker's back.
You fixing to go somewhere?
Same as you, I reckon.
I'm going to bar.
You'd be welcome to ride with me if you don't mind being in the company of a Blackwood.
I reckon we're all in this together.
I came by to speak to Annie. She here?
She was, but so was Sly Shipman. The two had been in the garden together just now, gathering up some vegetables. James didn't see them at the moment. He slid back the rail that served as a gate, led Walker outside, and swung up into the saddle.
I expect Annie's in the cabin. We'll go see.
As they rode around the dog run, he saw Annie and Shipman in each other's arms, oblivious to anything or anyone around them. Annie freed her hand and opened the door to her bedroom, then led Shipman inside and closed the door behind them. James felt his face turn warm, and he glanced at Isaac. Isaac looked as if a mule had kicked him. He swallowed hard and tore his gaze away from the closed door.
I reckon I'll be going on to bar. You coming?
I'm coming.
James found Isaac Blackwood to be a quiet traveling companion. Isaac spoke no more than was necessary, riding along with his mind elsewhere, holding counsel only with himself. James suspected he was thinking of Annie much of the time, grieving over lost opportunity. James also suspected that there never actually had been any real opportunity. Whatever her faults of temper and impatience might be, his sister was too bright to let herself be trapped into an alliance with a Blackwood, even a benign Blackwood such as Isaac seemed to be. James was relieved when on their first night's camp some other volunteers saw their fire and joined them. Now he had someone to talk to for the duration of the trip. He found that the old Mexican stone and adobe town of San Antonio de Bar was surrounded by arms-bearing citizens like himself, most impatiently waiting to do battle. General Cosa's Mexican troops were well entrenched. Part of them had taken up positions in an abandoned and partially crumbling mission, which had been used as a fortress from time to time ever since Mexico's first efforts to free herself from Spain. Because of the trees which had grown in profusion around it, the place was known by the Spanish name for cottonwood, Alamo. The sight of so many guns reminded him uncomfortably of Velasco 3 years earlier. He found little here to indicate much of a military organization. These were volunteers. Few had military training or experience in combat beyond, in some cases, a skirmish or two with Indians. They'd come here not so much an army as a ragtag collection of independent individualists who would follow an order only so long as it pleased them to do so. They were free men, not suited to any high degree of discipline. One reason they would never be good and willing citizens of a militaristic and authoritarian Mexico. The bloodletting at Velasco preyed heavily on James's mind and did not let him share in the eagerness of so many to open a full-scale battle with the Mexican soldiers. He remembered too well the smell of gunpowder and warm blood, the taste of fear in his mouth. He would fight when the time came, but he would not relish it nor glory in taking other men's lives. Velasco had burned that foolishness out of him forever. His immediate concern was to find Michael. Isaac Blackwood had come across a couple of acquaintances from an earlier time when he and his brothers had squatted near Nacogdoches, and James left him in their camp to reminisce. He set about visiting every encampment he could find, inquiring about his brother. He found to his surprise that Stephen F. Austin had returned. James had heard nothing about Austin's release from imprisonment in Mexico City. He had met the impresario a couple of times in San Felipe, but he would hardly have recognized him had he not known beforehand who he was. The Austin he saw in camp was haggard and pale and gray. The shadow of death lay in eyes that James had remembered as lively and quick. Prison had left him a broken man of just 42 years. To honor him for what he had done on behalf of Texas, he had been chosen to be general of this army of the people. It was done against his wishes, for he was not a military man and had little knowledge of battle tactics. As he had always done when unpleasant necessity had reared its head, he had accepted the responsibility, only to find a considerable division among the volunteers who ringed the town. Some wanted to negotiate costs of the troops out of Bar, but others, probably a majority, could smell blood and wanted to see it run. most of them had not been at Velasco. Austin was inclined toward negotiation, for that had always been his specialty. But that clearly was not to be. Cos seemed to have the advantage, numerical superiority, and a strong fortified position. But the farmers and frontiersmen whose rifles bristled around this old mission town had something more potent, a fire in the belly and a yearning to be free of Mexico. Even Austin, who had so long advocated conciliation and accommodation, had come to bitter disillusionment during his long incarceration. Independence was the only course for Texas now, he agreed. Independence from the internal power struggles and the vacillating policies of an unpredictable government that too often operated for the enrichment and the egos of those who happened to rule at any given moment, as Santa Anna did now. James found someone else, too. Alejandro Zaragoza was in charge of a company of Mexican volunteers of Republican sentiments, men who still remembered the high principles of the Mexican people in their proudest time, in the winning of their independence from Spain. Too often they had seen those principles trampled by one tyrant or another who managed for a while to grab the power of the central government. Santa Anna was but the latest. James shook hands with the Mexican farmer and ex-soldier, old friend of the Lewis brothers. He felt a warm respect for the courage of this man who had come back to his home in defiance of the proscription list that named him as one of several to be captured and punished for their principles. He looked quickly about the Mexican camp, half expecting to find Michael there.
Do you know where Michael's at? We haven't heard from him.
He was at Gonzales the last time we were together. He rode away with some other men. I think they were on their way to attack the garrison at La Bahia. What of my son Manuel? Tell me about him.
He's fine. Him and Mordecai, they're the best friends you ever saw. Where one goes, the other follows. He's grown up to be a fine man. How about the rest of your family?
They are well. I should be with them now, but this is more important. If we can force Cos to surrender, to leave Tejas, it will be a big defeat for Santa Anna. Cos is his brother-in-law, you know.
James nodded. He had heard that.
You don't suppose Michael's here somewhere in one of these camps?
I cannot say he is not, for there are so many I have not seen them all.
I'll keep looking. You be careful.
And you also.
James hunted until he was sure he'd visited every encampment in the vicinity of Bar. They ranged from company strength in a few cases to little groups of as few as 2 to 4 men. He lost track of the number, but knew it ran 700 or 800. People said more than 1,000 Mexican soldiers were garrisoned in the town. He finally had to concede that his search for Michael was futile. His brother was not here. He found Isaac Blackwood and decided the company Isaac had affiliated himself with was as good as any. Isaac asked him no foolish questions. James supposed the answer showed in his face.
Michael has always known how to take care of himself.
The Reverend Fairweather worked his way from one camp to another, calling men to listen to the word, offering up prayers for those who felt the need. James had been a disappointment to his mother in the matter of church attendance, but he felt drawn to Fairweather's service. The man's message left him with a measure of peace for a little while. He felt himself as ready as he would ever be for an assault upon the town. The rest of the men seemed equally primed, but the leadership waited, holding the existing positions, hoping the Mexicans could be starved into submission. Days passed and dragged into weeks. The men had come to do battle, but found themselves conducting a siege instead. That siege stretched into winter's cold. Rations ran short because there was no formal organization to provide for so many men. Volunteers gradually began pulling away to see about their families, left in isolated cabins and tiny settlements all over American Texas. Those who remained grumbled and fretted and shivered against the north winds, for most had left home in warm weather and had no heavy clothing to shelter them from November's cold. There was talk about a third Texas consultation back in San Felipe setting up a provisional government. James had little interest in politics and paid but scant attention. He did hear, however, that Stephen Austin and 2 others had been selected as commissioners to travel to the United States and plead for men, munitions, and money to aid the Texan cause. This was work for which Austin was better fitted than the conduct of a military campaign, though his fading health would make traveling dangerous for him. Austin gave up his command of the shrinking Texas Army and took the commission without complaint. He had never hesitated to give his all for Texas, and he did not shirk his final duty. The command at Barr passed to Edward Burleson. Still, the men waited, for their officers thought the Mexican fortifications appeared too formidable. Wait, they said. When the Mexicans had starved long enough, they would lay down their weapons and abandon the town. James acknowledged that this was probably the wisest course. It was certainly the safest one. But the inactivity, the cold, and his own hunger caused him to begin considering going home, as so many others had already done. He was cheered a little when 64 men of the New Orleans Grays marched into the main encampment, fresh from a voyage to the mouth of the Brazos on the schooner Columbus. They brought with them fresh provisions and military stores contributed by the people of New Orleans. It was the first sign James had seen that people elsewhere outside of Texas had an interest in what was happening here. A few days later, a tall, grim-faced adventurer named Jim Bowie took out a patrol. Bowie, an old hand in Texas and Mexico, was already a legend for the huge knife he carried on his hip and for the many desperate fights he was reputed to have won with it. His patrol confronted a Mexican pack train, thought to be bringing fresh provisions to the besieged troops, or possibly even money to pay the men. In a brief, bloody battle, the Mexicans lost some 50 men and all the mules. The victorious Texans tore into the packs, expecting to find food and ammunition, or perhaps gold and silver. They found only grass, cut to sustain the Mexicans' animals inside the city. But the skirmish aroused excitement in the encampment and gave James the resolve to stay a little longer. The officers were still not sure. To storm the fortifications would result in a terrible slaughter on both sides, some said. The Mexicans were not good fighters and would quickly give up, others argued. They debated at length while the men waited, impatient and angry over the indecision. Burleson and James W. Fannin favored giving up the siege for the winter and retreating to La Bahia, also known as Goliad, to await reinforcements before hitting Cos again in the spring. Then came a gangly old Texas veteran named Ben Milam, recently escaped from imprisonment in Mexico, embittered as Austin had been embittered, and out of patience with the long delay. He went about preaching a sermon of war and gathering a growing entourage. As Mexican patriots once had raised a grito against Spain, he raised a cry of his own.
Who will go with old Ben Milam into San Antonio?
James, caught in the momentum, surprised himself by adding his voice to the cheer. The officers who had counseled caution were helpless to stop the pent-up energy that erupted in the wake of Ben Milam's challenge. The storming of Barr began in the dark of a December early morning, sweeping past Cos's pickets in a rattle of small arms fire. In little groups, the Texans pushed forward, battling at close range for house after house against a stubborn Mexican resistance. Once into it, James felt his blood running hot, and whatever fears he carried into the fight were drowned by his fevered excitement. As daylight came, a pall of dark smoke hung over the edges of the town. Mexican artillery shook the walls, and the rattle of musket fire showed the extent of the battle. James joined other Texans in gathering the spent Mexican cannonballs to be fired back into the fortifications from which they had come. Nearly exhausted, he took rest when he could, rousing himself to go again when the call came to advance.
Come on, men! Let's give them what for!
It was a slow, murderous campaign fought by fits and starts, often hand-to-hand, knife-to-knife. Texan rifles and Mexican escopetas firing at point-blank range. When artillery and musketry made the streets too dangerous for the men to cross, they used logs for battering rams and drove holes through the stone and adobe walls, fighting from room to room, house to house, inexorably closing in on the Mexicans' main entrenchments. Texas fighters might have been farmers, but they were also hunters, and their marksmanship was as deadly here as it had been at Velasco. Wherever an enemy soldier showed his head, he was likely to lose it. The battle continued for 4 days and was finished without the fiery leadership of the man who had precipitated it.
Charles!
On the afternoon of the third day, old Ben Milam was leading a charge across a street and fell with a bullet in his brain. The battle went on, even as Milam was being buried in the courtyard of the house of the Veramendes, family of Jim Bowie's late wife. James had known nothing of Ben Milam before Milam had issued his challenge to the men, but he felt the loss as if the old fire eater had been a lifelong friend, and it brought home to him once again the high cost of war. But the die had been cast. There was no backing away, no retreat now, or all those who died would have died for nothing. So the fight went on, the Texan vise gradually tightening yard by yard, plaza by plaza, house by house, until on the fifth day, a white flag went up in the Alamo. General Kos was surrendering to a force a third the size of his own. James was caught up for a time in the euphoria of victory, but the glow began to fade when they came upon Elizondo Zaragoza and found the former soldier ashen-faced, his arm bound with white cloth through which a red stain had seeped. Zaragoza sat on the ground, his back propped up against the tall wheel of an ox cart. His Mexican compatriots, who had fought against the forces of Santa Anna, were gathered around him, not mixing with the victorious Anglo-Texans. James wondered if this was by their own choice or if they had found that the Texans were not quite ready to accept them, even though they had fought side by side. He suspected it was some of both. Though the men of two races who had taken Bar shared a wish to be free of tyranny, they were of different cultures. They looked differently and spoke different languages. No matter how much they might share, there was a line over which neither would cross. James knelt at Zaragoza's side.
I didn't know you'd been shot. At least it was just your arm.
Zaragoza tried to smile, but the effort did not succeed. His pain was obvious.
I have been shot once before in this same arm. Always it has been stiff. This will heal.
Isaac had not shaved since they had left the Colorado. He'd regained much of the rough backwoodsman look James remembered best. Zaragoza remembered him too, for he had encountered the Blackwoods before. He gave Isaac a look that said he didn't trust him, even though they had fought on the same side. He didn't know Isaac well enough to see any difference between him and his two brothers. Nor did Isaac know Zaragoza well enough to differentiate between him and the soldiers they had fought against. They were all of a dark skin, speaking an alien language. He stood back distrustingly while James visited with the man who had long been a friend to Michael and Andrew. The smell of smoke still clung heavily over the town. James's eyes burned from it, and he had to rub them. In doing so, he rubbed in dirt from his sleeve and made matters worse.
They say Kos has agreed to take the soldiers out of Texas and never come back. I guess the fighting's over.
Kos can agree, but Will Santa Anna, I think not. He does not give up Tejas so easily. I think he will be back. I think we must watch and be ready. I must go home now. Elvira will know how to treat my arm. Do you go home too, Jaime?
I don't see no reason to stay.
Would you please tell my son that he can come back to his family? We are safe. For now.
For now. James felt much of victory's glow go out of him. Zaragoza's pessimism was contagious.
You really think we'll have to fight again?
We have beaten only a little of Santana's army. When the grass comes in the spring and his horses can graze, I think Santa Anna will come. I think he will bring more army. We will watch, and we will wait. I hope we will be ready. Buena suerte, Jaime. I think we will see you and your rifle again in the spring.
James and Isaac walked away from Zaragoza's camp.
He's liable to be right. We're liable to have to do the whole thing over again when the grass rises.
Maybe not. I've sure had enough of this. Maybe the Mexicans have too.
Reverend Fairweather held a prayer service for those who wanted to express thanksgiving. James and Isaac bowed their heads. When the meeting was done, Isaac looked to James.
I expect you'll be going home now?
I don't see any need to stay. We'd just as well ride together if you want to.
Nah, I got no reason to hurry. Ain't nothing much waiting for me there. There's some that agree with Zaragoza. They think we ain't seen the last of the Mexican army. I've been studying on joining a company that's gonna follow Casa soldiers all the way back down to Rio Bravo to be damn sure they cross over and don't come back.
I heard he signed a paper saying he would never take up arms against Texas again.
Paper don't mean nothing. Anyway, Santiani wasn't here to sign it, so I think I'll just stay with the boys. Beats sitting around the cabin all winter watching Finnis and Luke and Nellie fight.
Isaac looked away toward the east.
Just one thing. You know the boy that's come with me from time to time over to see your sister?
Finnis's boy?
Maybe Finnis's boy. Maybe mine. If anything was to happen to me, if the Mexican army should come back, I wish you'd see that boy gets out all right.
James swallowed. It had never occurred to him that the boy might be Isaac's. But remembering Nellie, he couldn't be overly surprised.
All right.
And tell your sister... Well...
James waited for Isaac to finish, but Isaac had said all there was. James watched him walk away.
I'll do what I can.